In the case of China and India, the attacks of the Huns were directly responsible for the fact of the end of empire. In the case of the Roman Empire, the pattern is a little more complicated because the direct invaders of Rome were, for the most part, Germanic tribes who had been hovering on the borders of the empire for some time, some of them partly Romanized, some of them not. But the Germanic tribes themselves were pushed into the empire partly because of invasions from Central Asia, the Huns again. And as I noted, in one instance, the Huns attacked Italy quite directly. Okay, so the first factor involved in all cases was the new pressure of invasion. But we also know, frankly, that these invaders, although fearsome, would not have ended these great empires if the empires had been at the height of their vitality. The Germanic tribes, the largest group to press into classical territory, the Germanic tribes numbered at most a tenth of the population of the Roman Empire itself. There was no particular weapons advantage, no particular military edge for the invaders. The Huns were skillful horsemen, and they had developed stirrups, which allowed them to mount and shoot more effectively than cavalry had done previously. So there were some factors involved. But again, without any question, at the height of the Roman Empire or the height of the Han Dynasty, the military apparatus of the empires would have been amply sufficient to push these invaders back, possibly with some difficulty, but they would have won. All right, so something else is involved. Factor number two, less familiar but really crucial in the case of Rome for sure and China almost for sure. Factor two is a new incidence of disease hitting in the Roman case in the 4th and 5th centuries, possibly with some incidents a bit earlier. We don't know quite what these new epidemics were. Possibly this was the first incursion of smallpox outside of southern Asia. May have also involved measles, which can be a deadly disease for a population that had not previously been exposed and developed some inherent resistance. In any event, up to a quarter, possibly even a third, of the population of the Roman Empire was swept away by these disease factors. We know there was also an epidemiological crisis in China. We don't have the figures quite as firmly. But in two of the major cases, new patterns of disease causing massive levels of death clearly caused economic and social dislocation that helps explain why economies began to function less well, why there was more emphasis on economic localization as people worked hard to find available labor and pulled back from some of the more elaborate production and trade arrangements that had marked the empires at their height. Again, this kind of crisis would obviously have political implications because the governments would find it less easy to collect taxes. There would be more pressure from local landlords to compensate for their revenue decline by increasing their pressure on the local population. Disease factors clearly enter into the picture and maybe, although we're less accustomed to these explanations, may be a really big part of the story. The diseases probably spread from India, which as a more tropical area had had higher rates of disease previously and frankly was more accustomed to them. The kinds of trading connections with India that we discussed in the earlier lecture clearly helps explain why disease could now move more readily from one region to another with devastating effects when these diseases were unfamiliar, as they clearly were in these instances. So, we have two factors that are, to some extent, beyond at least normal human control. The pressure of invasion, which could have been handled, but then when compounded by devastating disease, disease that had economic effects, but probably also psychological effects, reducing the vitality, reducing the confidence of the peoples affected. We have a package that already is quite powerful. But it's obviously important to talk about a third set of causes. And this is the one where greatest attention has often focused, particularly in the Roman case, a package that has something to do with the human qualities, the institutional qualities of the empires involved. Pretty clearly, Though it's not always to tell which is the cart and which is the horse, pretty clearly, leadership deterioration was a factor in the decline of the great empires. Emperors, possibly because of inbreeding, possibly because of army interference in the case of Rome, emperors became, on the average, less talented. Once in a while, there'd be an exception like Diocletian or Constantine in Rome, but on the average, leadership quality deteriorated. Perhaps more interestingly, because it's a larger category within which leadership changes can be subsumed, possibly more interesting was an increased selfishness, an increased short-sightedness on the part of elites more generally. Upper-class people began to indulge in an appetite for pleasure, in an interest in short-term material advantage, short-term sensual indulgence. They began to be less willing to serve the state. They began to be less willing to serve in military leadership capacities. It was more important to have fun than to do the tough stuff of maintaining an empire. We see this clearly in the case of Rome. It's highly probable also in the case of Han China and Gupta India. And finally, although again this has been applied particularly to Rome, there may even have been a deterioration in morale of ordinary people. In the case of Rome, one refers to the bread and circuses that the empire had provided ordinary people in Rome, urging them to attend festivals, urging them to take largesse from the state, instead of devoting themselves to economic productive activity, devoting themselves to military service, etc. One symptom, certainly of population decline, probably also of changes in morale and social confidence, one symptom was that it became increasingly necessary to recruit foreigners, in the case of Rome, Germanic tribesmen, to serve in military forces because it was simply impossible to find enough ordinary citizens, previous inhabitants of the empire, to perform these duties. This is obviously a powerful causation package, and it has been written more broadly still in some renderings of world history. The fall of the great classical empires, and particularly the fall of Rome, raises almost inevitably the question, is there some inherent law in human history such that a successful civilization will have a period of infancy when it's developing its values and beginning its surge of expansion? A long period, if it is indeed successful, of adulthood, in which the mature institutions and ideas are forged, the empire reaches its height of expansion, but then followed, again, law of history, inevitably by old age, in which the empire, the civilization begins to totter, its sources of vitality yield to greater weakness, and finally it fades away altogether. This notion of a human-like pattern of existence for major societies was posited, among other things, by the great British world historian Arnold Toynbee, and it is a very, very tempting picture, i.e., civilizations will reach a height that they simply can't sustain because their bureaucracies will become more venal, more defensive, and less interested in the kind of innovation that created the vitality of the civilization in the first place. Upper classes will turn selfish, leadership will turn narrower, the whole system, the very success of the system, carries the seeds of its own destruction. And, equally obviously, this notion of laws of history, and particularly laws of history applied to the great classical examples, have tempted some observers in the 20th and 21st centuries to wonder whether these laws and the analogy of the fall of the great classical empires also may apply to societies today. Is the West, for example, on the same road that carried Rome to destruction? Are signs of unwillingness to serve in the military, efforts at tax evasion, clear corruption in the upper classes, are these patterns that will see the West, or possibly particularly the United States, follow the path that had been carved by the great classical empires because not just of the fact of this analogy, but because of the force of the laws of world history? Happily, or at least possibly happily, the laws of history notion in this case need to be modified for the classical period itself by a recognition that the actual fate of the different civilizations varied immensely from one case to another. So far, I have frankly cheated by arguing that we've got one type of decline and fall occurring in slightly different specific respects at slightly different chronological points. I've cheated. There are, in fact, four cases. And it's important to recognize these four and then to talk about why four rather than one. The easiest case, where I cheated particularly, is in the case of the Guptas. The fall of the Gupta Empire in India was a major development. It was followed by a long period, literally centuries, in which no large empires were created in India except as a result of invasion. Muslim invasion, later British invasion. The next time a really overarching Indian state was created by Indians themselves after the fall of the Gupta was frankly in 1947 with the creation of Indian democracy after the departure of the British. That's a long period, and that means that something did change in the Indian pattern after the fall of the Guptas. But India's cultural life continued. Hinduism would change, but it continued to spread, and its changes actually suggested new sources of strength. The Indian social system, the caste system, continued to define life, not changelessly, but the system itself was basically intact, and it too continued to spread territorially, reaching the southernmore parts of the subcontinent after the classical period. India's trade activity worsened perhaps a little bit in ensuing centuries, but India remained a very productive economy, vitally engaged in both internal and world trade. This was a significant change, in other words, but frankly not exactly the decline and fall of a civilization. The Chinese case, another specific, the Chinese case involves a more significant change. Here you're dealing with very real social as well as political dislocation. And the fall of the Han Dynasty was followed by literally 350 years, a very long time in Chinese history, in which central government institutions did not operate. China was divided politically into regional entities. Landlord power increased considerably. Invasions from the outside periodically marked the Chinese structure, so that you're talking not just about political dislocation, but social and economic dislocation as well. But a short-lived dynasty, the Sui dynasty, was reestablished, and with it came a period in which China basically recovered most of the institutions and cultural values that had described it under the Han. The Han were gone. That's ended. And the period of intervening chaos must be remembered. This was not a simple transition from Han dynasty to the next step. But the fact is that talking about the decline and fall of Chinese civilization clearly also would be misplaced. You're talking about a major, major interruption, but an interruption that did not destroy the capacity to remember what had gone before and, as conditions permitted, to revive this recollection in terms of an active reinstatement of institutions like bureaucracy, Confucianism, etc. More serious disruption by far than India, but not exactly the fall of Chinese civilization. The Roman case is at least twofold as well. The fall of civilization image obviously works most accurately in the case of Western Rome, the European part of Rome. Here, the authority of the state really did dwindle. Localized conditions began to prevail. Economic conditions deteriorated, trade fell, cultural levels declined, even with the assistance of support from Christianity. This is a real point at which the level of civilized activity tapers off for a considerable period. And then when it revives, because it ultimately will, it does not revive literally according to Roman dimensions. But in the eastern part of the empire, and the Emperor Constantine had, for purposes of political efficiency, created an Asian capital for the empire to parallel the Roman capital in the West. In the Southeast European and Middle Eastern part of the empire, particularly the Northern Middle East, the Roman Empire didn't clearly fall at all. It was replaced by what became known as the Byzantine Empire, which maintained many of the institutions of the empire itself, many of the cultural attributes. Indeed, one of the greatest codifications of Roman law occurred under the Byzantine Empire. So you're dealing with at least two cases in this instance. So we have a major series of developments. I don't want to detract from that. But it's not exactly a tidy civilization is born, it rises, and then it dies. It may inevitably get disrupted from time to time. That may be a law of history. But you don't know from history, we don't know from classical history, whether the result is going to be a massive change in the capacity of social institutions or a period of dislocation followed by revival. Either path is possible. Either path is illustrated by what happened in the classical period. This leads then to a brief revisiting of the analytical question that preoccupied us before. Now, instead of why decline and fall, why differential decline and fall? Factors include, obviously, invasions might be more or less severe. The pressure of the Germanic tribes on the western part of the empire, in the case of Rome, was markedly greater than the pressure in the east. So one of the reasons the eastern empire fared much better than the west, it had less outside attack to contend with. India was probably less affected than China or Rome because, as we discussed earlier, it was accustomed to the disease patterns and not nearly as adversely affected by some new wave of epidemic. It's also possible, particularly in the Roman West, that despite the glory of Rome compared to India and China, the institutions and values of empire may have been slightly less deep-seated. The emphasis on integration, the emphasis on pulling the empire together in terms of bonds of loyalty may have been somewhat less successful. As we've discussed previously, the Roman Empire was a little bit more decentralized, a little bit more tolerant of local variation. No great cultural system to match Confucianism or Hinduism was tossed up by the empire. Therefore, there may have been less vigorous bonds of attachment between ordinary people and the empire itself. Certainly when the going got bad, as it clearly did in Western Rome, ordinary people frequently abandoned the empire with surprising willingness, often talking about greatly preferring the Germanic invaders to the Romans who had been seen as warlords and taxation agents. Whether this was because of the severity of the moment or whether it suggested a longer-term disaffection, hard to say. But it is certainly tempting to speculate that the Roman Empire, at least Western Rome, fared particularly badly, not just because the factors that pressed on it were unusually huge, but because it was somewhat less solid in the first place. At least it's worth some comparative analysis. So what does this all add up to? Obviously, it does not add up to a fully even picture. But despite the variety and despite the importance of recognizing that our image of fall attaches only to one part of one of our classical cases, there were three durable changes that really mark the reason that we use the fall of the great empires to note the end of a period and the beginning of a new one. First, and this is true for China and India as well as Rome, it's least true actually for what became the Byzantine Empire. In much of the civilized world, the formation of empire, the emphasis on empire, now at least for some time diminished. Societies were either less capable of maintaining these large integrated political structures or were less interested in it or both. So while empire does not disappear in the next phase of world history, it's certainly less emphasized. It becomes much less a focal point. Which leads to the second general result. The deterioration of this worldly conditions, economic, political decline in the cases particularly of China and Rome, inevitably helped push people to think about cultural alternatives to the kinds of political values that had described the classical period. And not surprisingly, the end of the classical period and the beginning of the next period in world history would be marked by a much greater religious emphasis than had been true of the classical period itself, particularly outside India. And finally, although this is a geographically confined result, the changes in the Roman Empire did mark what seems to be a permanent division of the Mediterranean world, ultimately into three different entities: Western Europe, the Northern Middle East, Southeastern Europe, and the rest of the Mediterranean coast, including North Africa. This division of the Mediterranean, which had always been at least a tentative entity in the classical period under the Greeks, the Hellenistic kingdoms, and certainly the Romans, this division of the Mediterranean would mark the next phase of world history and would continue to mark world history right up to the present day, again, a result of this major period of collapse and transformation.
Lecture 10, The Post-Classical Period, 500 to 1450.
We're talking today about the post-classical period in world history, its general contours. It's a period that runs from about 500 CE to about 1450 CE. You could argue maybe a little later. You could argue 1450, give or take. But we're talking about roughly not quite a 1,000-year span of the human experience. The purpose of our discussion today is to talk about the general nature of this period, what its basic themes were. And I'm going to begin, at risk of a little personalization, by talking about the way this period looked when I first became engaged in world history on a high school project some years back. When we were thinking about how to block out the project, and none of us was all that experienced in world history at that point, we had a lot of fun with the river valleys, and we could talk about the classical civilizations. And then when we got to the more modern era, we were in good shape. But for this block, we really didn't know what to say. So I think we stumbled around something like Age of Separations or Age of Incoherence or some nonsense that suggested that all we could do for this period was to tell a whole batch of separate stories and hope that people didn't get bored and hope that people didn't realize we had no basic themes at all. Well, in point of fact, the post-classical period is one of the periods that has been most reshaped by world history work, not mine, that of others. And it is indeed one of the most exciting periods to try to teach. But before we talk about what the positive themes are, a couple of words on why it used to seem, and maybe to some people still seems, like this is a particularly confused stage of the human experience. There are two reasons. Most obviously, and this simply has to be grappled with, the geographical territory now organized in civilization as a form of human organization, as we've discussed it earlier, the territory now expands greatly. So you're talking about much larger stretches of geography than was true for the classical period. At the same time, no matter how you cut the cake, the number of separate civilizations also has to be expanded. In the classical period, obviously, we got by with three or four basic foci. Can't do that for the post-classical. You got to have more cases, and we'll talk about that during the course of our discussion in this session. So the superficial reason that the post-classical period seems complicated is not really all that superficial. There are more cases. There are greater complexities. The second reason, however, that this period can seem off-putting is because in the European history tradition, this period is exactly the period known as the Middle Ages, the medieval period. We don't use that word for the whole world in world history because the connotations are just wrong. But the European Middle Ages were always themselves a bit of a catch-all. The implication was that after the glories of Greece and Rome, and before the glories of the Renaissance, there was this somewhat awkward stretch of the European experience where you could ultimately talk about some growing strengths and revivals, but much of which was defined as a bit of a civilizational wasteland. Well, for world history, this is a non-starter. The post-classical period was a period of great dynamism, all sorts of major innovations, all sorts of extremely vigorous societies, and medieval Europe would be only a small part, at the end a growing part, but a small part of this larger experience. To the extent, though, that we're still trapped in notions of Middle Ages, of lack of vigor, of civilizational deterioration, this may color our view of this period, but this one's easy. Just throw it away, start over. The post-classical period is different. Periodization, and we're talking and trying to define the classical, post-classical period, we're talking about periodization. Periodization is the historian's key analytical tool. And when we introduce a new period in world history, in United States history, wherever, if we're analytically honest, we're trying to say this: there is a change in framework, so that the framework that had described the human experience or the relevant chunk of experience previously no longer is front and center. A different framework replaces it, and developments and changes within this new period would work within this new framework until the period itself ends and yields to another. So, without belaboring the technicalities here, when we introduce a new period, we owe our audience three things. One, we need to say clearly and hopefully prove that the themes of the previous period no longer have dominant operation. They may still be a factor, but they're no longer dominant. Two, we need to say when the new period comes into play, and also, at the other end, when it stops being particularly salient. And then three, and this is the most important part, we need to say what the new themes are, in the world history case, what the themes are to which other major societies, most major societies, will have to react. All right, point one, hopefully easy. We did some of this last time. The end of the classical period, the fall of the great classical empires, means that we no longer look primarily to the processes of expansion of China, India, and the Mediterranean, and the integration devices these societies would develop to try to hold these expanded territories together. The remnants of this effort are still quite visible, but the effort itself is no longer predominant. China and India are essentially established. They'll change, but you no longer have to talk about expansion that will create the geographical framework for China, or the basic integrating devices, the institutions of empire, Confucianism, that will be used to hold it together. They're already there. Same basically for India, with Hinduism and the caste system. And you're certainly not going to talk in this new period about the continued expansion and integration of the classical Mediterranean, because it's burst apart. So, first point, hopefully easily established. The old themes, their mark is still there, but the old themes are no longer dominant. Second point, the chronological boundaries. Pretty obviously, the beginning of the post-classical period is marked first by the fall of Han China, Gupta India, and the Roman Empire, and second, on a more positive note, by the emergence of the Arabs and Islam as a new force in world history. There are important centers of activity besides the Arabs and Islam during the post-classical period. Notably, the Byzantine Empire would have a significant voice in affairs in the Eastern Mediterranean and in Eastern Europe, and China would revive to play a major role in East Asia. But in the post-classical period, beginning indeed around 600, the Arabs, with their new religion of Islam, emerge as a major force in world history, and Arab-Islamic civilization really becomes the first world-class civilization that we have dealt with in world history thus far. In the classical period, you could haggle a bit about which of the three major centers was primarily influential. Probably India would win because it had the greatest commercial and cultural outreach, but it's not a very sensible discussion. But in the bulk of the post-classical period, the vigor, activities, outreach of Islam and the